911 emergency.
Yes, I'm in the middle of the field. It's like we're just pushing guys over. Right here going towards Javelin on both sides. My truck ran out of gas. There's one car here. You got to take it to the woods. Please hurry.
Okay, now run that by me.
We're not talking to him. I still ran into him.
Ah, you ran into him. Okay.
That's the first guy.
You need an ambulance?
Yes, no, I need the cops.
Okay. Is anybody hurt? Hello? Hello? Hello?
Hey everybody, welcome back to episode 7 of Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, taking this train off the rails once more as we examine the disappearance of Brandon Lawson, a 26-year-old father and oil field worker from Texas who makes a mysterious and harrowing 911 call after running out of gas while driving along a desolate Texas highway in the early morning hours of August 9th, 2013, and is never seen again. But was this a simple case of a man getting stranded in the middle of the night and losing his way, as some people seem to think? Or was there something more sinister going on? Let's find out. So we'll backtrack to the events that precipitated the 911 call, specifically what happened in the late evening hours of August 8, 2013. Now, Brandon at this time lives in San Angelo, Texas with his pregnant common-law wife, LaDessa Lofton, whom he's been in a relationship with since high school, in addition to their three young children. Apparently, there was some type of heated argument between the parents, and Brandon became frustrated to the extent he left the home just prior to midnight in his pickup truck. This was supposedly a generalized argument regarding various issues, Brandon starting a new job soon, a sick child in the home, etc. It isn't too difficult to imagine the young parents of three kids, with another on the way, having disagreements and worries about a lot of things, primarily money. So long story short, Brandon needs to cool off, and he walks out of the home wearing white Nike Air Max shoes, camo shorts, and a yellow tap-out shirt. He calls his father in Crowley, Texas, and says he's going to head his way to stay the night. Being that it's after midnight and it would be more than a two-hour drive, his father tells him to just turn around and go home to LaDessa to work things out. But he doesn't. And this is the moment we need to slam on the brakes and bring this event to a jarring halt, simply because nothing is disputed to this point. This is where most people analyzing the circumstances breeze right through to the 911 call to find out what went wrong. There's this overwhelmingly strong notion that if someone can just finally comprehend exactly what Brandon is saying in the call, that we would know what happened to him. But we wouldn't, let me assure you. And the reason is because he isn't telling the truth, at least not to an extent that his words would divulge honesty beyond the context of being in trouble. What is available, however, is subtext, and we can also account for motivation, at least to a certain extent. Combined, this cocktail is surely going to reveal far more than any type of audio analysis could ever hope to achieve. So where do we start? We start by asking, why? Why did Brandon decide that driving 2 hours to his father's house in the middle of the night was a better idea than going home and working things out with LaDessa? According to the family, they regularly had spats where one of them would leave for 20 to 30 minutes and then return. Yet Brandon did not do so this time. This is the why we need answer to proceed. Well, the easy answer is that Brandon was clearly more upset than he'd been during those previous arguments and felt his actions subsequent to this current argument required a greater degree of blowing off steam. Now, the easy correlation to make is to suggest that more time away from LaDessa than 20 or 30 minutes was necessary. In fact, we not only know the severity of the incident in relation to time, but also distance. Brandon felt that he needed to be more than a two-hour drive away from LaDessa to make things okay. And we know he felt very strongly about this because his father couldn't deter him from the notion of doing so. The resulting equation then becomes this. Brandon's desire to escape his circumstances, at least in his mind, could be accommodated within 250 miles from his home, the approximate distance between Crowley and San Angelo, and also within the context of only staying the night, as he explicitly told his father. So from a psychological standpoint, we can safely say Brandon was probably not completely fed up with his life, no matter how mad he was, and simply did not just take off, never to be seen again. So from here, we need to stick our noses out this window he created and take in the panoramic view to get a better understanding. If Brandon drives to his father's house, he'll not only have a few hours alone in the vehicle each way, but also the time at dad's house the rest of the night and the next morning to be away from the things that are bothering him back at home. And while I don't know for sure, I assume Brandon was not supposed to be at any type of job the next day, as he was supposed to be starting a new job shortly. Yet his father probably was scheduled to work the next day and would likely not be around. Nor would Brandon see much of the man when showing up at his house in the middle of the night. You figure he lets the kid in, says hello, and goes back to bed. And what does all of this tell us? It says that Brandon wanted to be alone somewhere that he felt comfortable because he couldn't achieve this peace otherwise. Of course, that's strong motivation for anyone, especially when angry. But I cannot proceed in good conscience here because I know the marriage of his proposed motivation and action truly mix like oil and water. Simply put, nobody drives to their dad's house hours away just because they're pissed off. Unless there is justification and or rationalization involved that renders this awkward action as simply a stepping stone to achieving Brandon's ultimate desire. The problem then becomes assessing what his true desire is. Well, if we've established he only wants to create a short time and distance between his family and him before returning, then we need to consider what he believes will provide him such great catharsis in these tight confines. The answer is that there is nothing that can legitimately accommodate this goal, as Brandon's problems are clearly ongoing, in the form of bills, children, marital issues, etc. There is absolutely no action he can take to remedy the situation, and his father confirms this much by telling him to stay home. But Brandon persists anyhow. So if we know Brandon persists with his desire in the absence of sound logic, and despite his father's urging, then we can easily assess that his true desire is of a greater magnitude, at least in his mind, than that which we have been privileged to by way of explicit information. Basically, he's not telling us what he really wants, which could be defined, by default, as deception. And one stoops to deceit only in circumstances where achieving his desire is entirely dependent upon what? Keeping a secret. And when people request information from somebody who's trying to keep a secret, what happens? The person lies to protect his interests because they are of such great importance to him, but not anyone else. So if you ask yourself what would have been of the utmost importance in Brandon's mind, that which he was sure would not be any type of priority in the minds of his family members, to the extent that he would absolutely not tell them the truth, we can then understand he was operating within an abnormal logic that was not only unique to him, but to the situation. So the next question naturally becomes, why do people lie? The answer, to avoid repercussions of the truth. But why would there be repercussions to Brandon staying at his father's house for a night after an argument with his wife? He's just going there to cool off. It's not like he's partying. Or is he? You see, in a sane person, any actions taken within the disunity between poor logic and strong desire are indicative of a chaotic mental state desperately seeking relief, regardless of what precipitated it, and therefore, by default, necessitate that the end goal is correcting the emotional issue, not a tangible problem that can be solved over time, a struggle that would be represented by a unity between the opposing values of strong logic and poor desire. For example, what if Brandon doesn't want to turn around and go home to talk things out with Ledessa, poor desire, but does so anyway because it's the fastest and most direct route to resolving the issue at hand, strong logic? With that said, we then need to answer this question. What could provide such relief for this chaotic mental state, and do so with qualities that perfectly parallel the desire to engage the disunity between strong desire and poor logic? Furthermore, what could attain the goal that would upset family members to the point you'd need to lie? Drugs. Of course, I have no evidence he was on drugs, so why am I so convinced simply by applying a bit of logic to the situation? Isn't this insensitive and rude? No. Consider the correlation between what I just said and Brandon's next action. What does he do? Knowing he can't make the trek to the gas station on the fuel left in his truck, He tries to anyway. It is already a fact that he's going to run out of gas prior to achieving his goal, and he knows it. But this happens because he is already operating in the context of an addict. He knew he needed to get gas before leaving town, but his desire to, quote, get away is so elevated it's causing him to abandon strong logic in favor of confidence. But one cannot generate authentic confidence as it pertains to victory in the face of inevitable defeat. However, this confidence can be produced synthetically, in the form of meth. So here's where I need to duck, where the virtual beer cans and banana peels get thrown in my face. But the thing is, I'm not here to be nice. I'm not here to say Brandon was a flawless man who should be remembered that way. My goal is nothing more than to say something that might spark a thought, memory, or otherwise that could one day help bring answers to a situation that deserved it. I have listened to the 911 call too many times to count. And while the words are never clear to me, what remains transparent is that Brandon has not been drinking alcohol, but is definitely intoxicated. More on that shortly. Okay, so here we are in the truck with Brandon, heading north on Highway 277. This is where most people immediately jump to him running out of gas, then running into trouble, and finally disappearing. So I'm going to play the call for you again right now, in the context of him still being on the road, so that you can place the beginnings of this incident not after he pulls over, but prior. The one element in this case that I believe has truly hindered perception in a negative way is thinking that he had a run-in with somebody, or some people, on the side of the road. But I'm going to show you why it didn't happen that way. Here's the call, which of course doesn't actually take place until after he abandons the vehicle.
911 emergency.
Yes, I'm in the middle of the field. It's like we're just pushing guys over. Right here going towards that wind on both sides. My truck ran out of gas. There's one car here. You got to take the woods. Please hurry.
Okay, now run that by me.
We're not talking to him. I still ran into him.
Ah, you ran into him. Okay.
That's the first guy.
You need an ambulance?
Yes, no, I need the cops.
Okay. Is anybody hurt? Hello?
Okay, so obviously we're going to talk about what he says in this tape, but I'm not going to play clips repetitively to try to prove what appears in the audio. I'm just going to work from a generalized account of what the words might be, specifically in order to examine that which Brandon does not say, because once again, I detect a certain degree of deception in this 911 call on his part. The beautiful part of these lies, however, is that there's no amount of poor audio that could prevent us from using them to learn the truth. So here's an approximation of what Brandon says in the call. 911 emergency. Yes, I'm in the middle of a field. Just pushed some guys over. We're out here going towards Abilene on both sides. My truck ran out of gas. There's one car here. The guy's chasing me through the woods. Please hurry. Okay, now run that by me one more time. There'll be no talking to him. I accidentally ran into him. Oh, you ran into him? Okay. Someone says something in the background. Brandon says, just the first guy, or that's the first guy. Then there's a loud noise like a gunshot in the background. 911 asks, do you need an ambulance? And it sounds like somebody chuckles and says, yeah. Some people say it's not Brandon. Others say it is. It's really hard to determine. But we do know right after that, Brandon says, no, I need the cops. And 911 follows with, okay, is anybody hurt? Hello? 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 Brandon does not respond. A background noise gets louder and louder as if he's getting closer. Obviously, you know, we're picking that up through the phone. Now, again, it's fine if you disagree with the translated text. We only need a general idea of the circumstances because we're going to fill in the blanks where he's withholding information that would help to understand what actually happened. Most people assert that the reason Brandon can't articulate the issue very well is because he's scared. And another theory is that it's because he's intoxicated. But I'm suggesting that, while he was under the influence of something, this was not what prevented clarity in his presentation. The responsibility for that burden belongs solely to his conscience, for often the victim of a crime starts as the perpetrator. For instance, when two kids get in a fight at the schoolyard. It isn't the one who started the altercation by throwing the first punch who most often gets caught in the teacher's eyes. It's the kid who retaliates. The reason for this is the initial punch is not precipitated by anything, so casual observers are far less likely to realize it ever occurred. Likewise, we only learn of Brandon's incident after whatever takes place to initiate it. More specifically, we are only notified at the point he feels he's become a victim, i.e., after there was retaliation for the first punch. But what we really need to understand is that whomever is chasing Brandon is retaliating. But how do we know this if we didn't see who started it? Well, Brandon comes right out and tells us. And before I explain this, I want everybody to do me a huge favor. If you believe you hear the words state trooper, or even a combination of those words oddly constructed as staper in the 911 call, get them out of your head right now. I can't explain those words away, but I can say definitively that they are a slippery slope from which your mind will not return if it's indulged long enough. It causes a mental block and leads to the ludicrous possibility that there were three parties involved in this altercation, including at least one cop, and it then managed to remain entirely under wraps. That's not very realistic, and the circumstances upon which it would have to be predicated are not exactly believable. So again, put yourself back in the truck on that night. You're Brandon. Now listen to these words, and it's apparent Brandon was never in a situation where he was walking the highway alone toward the gas station. This incident happened much earlier in the timeline. Here it is. 911 emergency. Yes, I'm in the middle of a field. Just pushed some guys over. Out here going towards Abilene on both sides. My truck ran out of gas. There's one car here. Guys chased me through the woods. Please hurry. What Brandon is trying to tell the operator is that he was on the road, still driving, when an incident occurred between him and the driver of another vehicle with a passenger that caused each vehicle to run parallel to each other on the road, at which point both vehicles were headed towards Abilene on both sides of the road, right next to each other. What we can infer from this is that Brandon made some type of move, perhaps in passing, that annoyed another driver. Due to the resulting placement of the vehicles next to each other, it is then reasonable to believe the purpose of this was for the driver who was wronged to pull up alongside Brandon's vehicle and voice his displeasure, whether it was a middle finger or even a wave of a loaded handgun to show he meant business. Of course, this situation also could have happened in reverse, with the second driver being the one to pull a terrible driving move and Brandon being the one to retaliate. I mean, we have to remember that Brandon was in an incredibly bad mood, so his behavior at the time would be conducive to something like this, even if it was out of character for him. So the important thing, however, is that we understand the vehicles were alongside each other while traveling on the road afterward, at which point, in Brandon's own words, just pushed some guys over, or just pulled some guys over, we're out here going towards Abilene on both sides. My truck ran out of gas. What Brandon is telling the operator, and intentionally doing so with too little information because what he's saying constitutes a crime, is that he realized he was going to run out of gas and couldn't get away from the other vehicle, so he tried to run them off the road. And this, right here, is where we understand why Brandon was chased down and attacked. Again, think about this. Poor logic, strong desire. That is the manner in which he acted. He tried to run somebody off the road with no gas in his truck. It's also the reason why we can't understand the 911 call. Brandon doesn't want us to. He's in a situation where he's absolutely scared to death, but it's still a fact he has an outstanding warrant for his arrest on a previous drug charge from years earlier, and could even be charged with a much more serious crime if the cops show up. Trying to run somebody off the road could be construed as something as serious as attempted murder, and you have to think Brandon realizes this. In the meantime, however, he does not possess the exceptional analytical ability and foresight that would be required to simultaneously talk his way out of this mess with an approaching attacker and an operator on a recorded 911 call. I believe his drug use, combined with the necessity to lie in a dire rushed situation where his life was immediately at stake, caused him to try to satisfy the need to thwart the following threats all at once: his family learning the truth, the man coming at him, and the forthcoming inquisition of the police. I mean, if you just take a look at a few pictures of this guy, at the bright nature of his eyes and smile, you can see that, while he most likely was not accelerating the technology of rocket science in a lab at NASA, the speech utilized on the 911 call entirely betrays his actual level of intelligence. Now, let's go back to what I mentioned about his predisposition to drug use and correlate the psychology to the 911 call. Here's the breakdown. In the 911 call, Brandon clearly exhibits strong desire and poor logic, again, evidenced by the fact he's telling the cops to hurry, but never provides his exact location where they can find him. It's then easy to see the disunity between strong desire and poor logic also led to this result, in exactly the same way he decided to depart for his father's home that night, and the same way he decided to run somebody's truck off the road with no gas in his. We know this is true because fear does not alter logic. It merely causes us to make different choices within our natural framework. Drugs, however, do alter logic, and more specifically, they alter our responses to fear, especially meth. If you were sober and a man with a gun was chasing you, you'd stop only at the point he shot you dead or you dropped due to exhaustion. But if you were on meth, you might actually think it's a decent idea to stop and call the cops in this situation. In fact, if you were on meth and your adrenaline was pumping, your answer as to whether you needed an ambulance might be without merit. In fact, you could already be shot and have no idea whatsoever at this point. Moreover, you might even be on a phone call with 911 while the man is shooting at you. And if you were shot and didn't realize it, it might cause a sense of confusion that then becomes apparent in your speech, without you so much as slurring a word. Okay, so this is what comes next in the 911 call. My truck ran out of gas. There's one car here. A guy's chasing me through the woods. Please hurry. So, like I said, Brandon tries to run the other car off the road, but it obviously doesn't work. Or, you know, perhaps he just didn't really commit to it because it's not the type of person he really is. You know, he was just desperate at the time. So, anyway, maybe he just did it as a threat and merely swerved at them. Either way, these people are angry now, and Brandon's truck is sputtering to a halt. And here's how we know this happened. The vehicle was pulled over on the side of the road, but with the tail end of the driver's side still out on the pavement. Now, we have to assume that he knows this shows a disregard for the safety of the vehicle or other drivers, especially at night without the use of his flashers. But what it does is prevent a faster-moving vehicle from pulling directly beside him and trapping him before he can get out of the truck when it stops, which would be inevitable if he made the usual move in that case, even though he could still potentially climb over the seat and jump out the passenger side. But it's important to note that he abandoned the normal final move of making the vehicle parallel with the road in order to park most safely. So, let's backtrack here for a second. In terms of Brandon running the other car off the road, we have, again, the disunity between strong desire, get rid of these people now, and poor logic, run them off the road, resulting in something we can't seem to reconcile. This is how we predict the nature of the 911 call he's about to place. All of his actions that began with the decision to utilize poor logic and strong desire started with the idea of driving to his father's house. And, with all of these actions being part of the same incident, we can then conclude they will all follow suit thereafter. Accordingly, the reason we never see Brandon alive again is that combining poor logic and strong desire is antithetical to maintaining a physical existence on this earth. Ultimately, Brandon was a victim of his choices, and this is, quite simply, what happened to him. But that doesn't satisfy our curiosity. I mean, we're not just trying to figure out if he's deceased, right? We want to know how this went down. All right, let's take a look at the rest of what he says in the 911 call. Now, at this point, what I propose is that Brandon pulled the truck to a stop, jumped out, and ran into the brush. He refers to it in the call as the woods, but I grew up in Pennsylvania, and to my eye, there's not one item in this field he's talking about that I would refer to as a tree. It's all bushes, as unforgiving as the terrain might be. So if you were thinking of this as a place where he could find refuge, think again. And that's how we know what happened next, in Brandon's words. My truck ran out of gas. There's one car here. A guy's chasing me through the woods. Please hurry. Okay, run that by me one more time. There'll be no talking to him. I accidentally ran into him. Oh, you ran into him? Okay. Just the first guy. Do you need an ambulance? No, I need the cops. Okay, is anybody hurt? Hello? 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 And of course, we have a few gunshots mixed in there, or loud noises that could potentially be gunshots, and something motorized moving closer and closer to the phone. So let's get back to the angle at which the truck is parked and look a little further into the psychology of this choice. As humans who are very goal-oriented, we generally aim our feet at things we desire, therefore aligning our eyes with the same. With vehicles being designed in the vein of human anatomy, it's reasonable to suggest the headlights and tires are the eyes and feet of the vehicle, respectively. So Brandon tells us where he ran with this action because he projected that desire in the form of the direction in which he parked. This seems to make sense because he has two apparent goals at this point. One, to escape the danger in the form of the men chasing him. And two, to still remain close enough to the road that he can receive the help of the cops he's about to call, because he doesn't have a frame of reference to offer about his location other than the road he's traveling and where his truck is parked. So here's where Brandon has a head start and needs to prioritize the nuances of this escape. His first action is to get off the road because the car chasing him can obviously run him over, if the driver so chooses. The second consideration in that initial action is finding cover as he runs through the darkness, so as to make himself more elusive, specifically to somebody on foot. So this is where we understand Brandon's reference in the 911 call to either "that's the first guy" or some variation of that, like "just the first guy." What is easily distinguishable, however, is that he says "the first guy." This denotes the presence of at least two men, and given the circumstances, only two men, as we can only correlate what happens next to a total of two people present, aside from Brandon, due to the information we have. If there were more people present, their actions were only supplemental to the other two men, meaning they assisted in the aftermath of the other men's actions. Here's how we know. The other car pulls to a halt behind Brandon's truck, or alongside. The passenger gets out, and naturally, because he wasn't the man behind the wheel charged with keeping the car on the road, he is also far more likely to have brandished a gun. So one man with a gun chases Brandon into the brush. That's the first guy, or just the first guy. Either way, Brandon is fumbling through his pocket for his phone at this point, while running as fast as he can to escape. He's out of breath, looks back, and not only sees the other car stop next to his, but hears and sees the man with the gun chasing him. As he dials 911, he starts to run again, but realizes he's too exhausted to run and talk at the same time, so he stops. Meanwhile, the other driver is able to determine where he is by watching the direction in which his buddy is stalking Brandon. Accordingly, as I mentioned with the angle of Brandon's park job, we know he was in the brush not too far from the road, not quite running parallel along it, but also not running directly away from the road because that would negate the potential help of the cops. So the driver sees Brandon and puts the car in drive. He crawls along the road as he watches his buddy hunt the slow-moving 5'9", 230-pound prey who's running out of breath as he goes. Now, an important thing to also note here is that whether he was on meth or not, Brandon is not a world-renowned long-distance runner. And while meth might provide incredible access to physical strength and raging determination in the case of a short-term altercation, it certainly isn't going to vastly increase your cardiovascular capacity over the course of a continuous sprint over unforgiving terrain. Furthermore, while it might allow one to run after getting hit with a bullet, it isn't going to allow anybody to outrun a bullet. So this is where Brandon stops and makes the 911 call with the man approaching him. Now let's consider how the man would approach. He knows Brandon is afraid, but that isn't enough to confirm that Brandon isn't armed. This is Texas. So, when Brandon stops, the man would naturally slow down as well and move in carefully as he assesses the situation better from a closer distance, especially in the dark. What he is then most likely to do, not only as a preventative measure, but to precipitate his potential next action, is raise the gun. Now walking, or stalking, he is better able to aim and notices Brandon lift the phone to his ear. This action specifically informs the attacker that Brandon is calling for help, something that urges him to take action, quickly, because what's clearly inferred just by the sight of this phone is that the cops are going to come. Basically, it's now or never. And that's the gunshot we hear in the background of this call. In fact, there might be more than one. And then what do we hear? We hear that man talking in the background. But then there's something else. Something motorized. And it's getting closer and closer to Brandon's phone. It's the car pulling alongside them on the road. Now the 911 operator asks Brandon if he needs an ambulance. But he says no, he needs the cops. Yet we know he's being shot at by this point. So then what we need to ask ourselves is this. If a man who is being chased and shot at stops to make a 911 call because he's exhausted and realizes he can't escape, what would then convince Brandon to start running again? I mean, he tells the operator he doesn't need an ambulance, and that's the last thing he says. So remember that gunshots missing him are not enough to get him on the phone or running again, and as we know he later called his brother, he doesn't die when the call ends abruptly moments later. But what does happen when Brandon makes that later call to his brother is that, even while the reception was terrible, he notes that he's bleeding. So if one is being shot at during a phone call that ends abruptly, and is bleeding when he connects on a different call with somebody else, the most rational correlation we can make is that Brandon Lawson was bleeding because he'd been shot. Naturally, the scared young man starts running again after being shot, but with all due respect, he's basically become little more than a wounded deer fruitlessly trying to escape the hunter following its blood trail through the forest. And this is where we're forced to speculate without much additional information to help piece together the puzzle. Some believe Brandon might have been so whacked out on drugs that he simply walked off into the brush when he ran out of gas and became disoriented. I argue, however, that if he had died in this manner, the location of his body in the aftermath would be likely more readily available to detection, especially given that aerial searches were conducted. What I propose is that Brandon escaped these two men for a short time, maybe even losing them for a few minutes. And before you call me a maniac for suggesting that an exhausted man who's been shot because he wasn't able to escape on foot finally escapes on foot once he's wounded, let me explain how this transpires. We later learn that a passing motorist, supposedly a truck driver, calls 911 around this time to report Brandon's vehicle parked with its tail end out in the road. In order to get the plate, he'd have to slow his vehicle at what is currently the scene of a violent crime, even if he can't see anything that's happening out in the field. Now, we have to assume the driver chasing Brandon on the road, as well as the man chasing him in the field, were first aware of this approaching truck when its headlights were in the distance. The only logical move at that point is for the man on foot to run back to the car at the urging of his buddy driving the car, and they drive off in order to not be seen by the approaching truck driver. Meanwhile, Brandon is in total darkness in the field, perhaps injured, definitely exhausted, and too far from the road at this point after being chased to make it back to the truck to be seen or heard by the driver before he pulls away. Now, it is possible the driver reports the vehicle without a plate, just based on make and model, or the fact that it's a truck just seeing partially in the road. But given his level of concern in calling the police, we have to believe he at least slowed to take in the scene, most likely to see if the driver was in the vehicle and needed help. Of course, Brandon sees the truck driver pulling away and is trying to wave him down, but finally realizes this lifeline is gone because he can't see him. So his hope now is that not only has his own 911 call drawn the cops in his direction, but he's thinking the truck driver might have just done the same due to finding the abandoned vehicle and slowing to check it out. So it goes without saying at this point, he needs to get back to his truck roadside as fast as possible. So he hobbles out of the field toward the vehicle, but sees headlights coming back the other way. For a moment, he thinks it might be the cops and feels the excitement of being rescued. He picks up his pace and hurries to the roadside to make himself known. But then he realizes it's the car that had been chasing him. You see, it's risky to come back if you're the perpetrators. But what's worse is that they shot a man who's still breathing, who can identify them, and likely saw the license plate on their car when they took off due to the truck approaching. Very simply, they have no choice. They can try to finish the job and get out before the cops arrive, or they can go home and hope to God the cops don't show up at their door by morning to arrest them for something that's inevitably going to lead to prison time. So Brandon takes off again, this time with a much bigger head start, but also with greater adversity because he's bleeding now. The men in the car use the same tactic they did previously, where one drives and one hunts, but this time they have to track Brandon down in darkness, even though they know he can't be far. Brandon calls his brother again in the meantime, and also makes numerous calls to his common-law wife, Ledessa, which go unanswered because he took the wall charger for their phones when he left the home, and her battery subsequently died. I think what most likely happens from here is that Brandon takes off, and reality slowly sets in as he bleeds from the wound, or wounds, and he loses steam. His adrenaline probably carries him for a bit, enough that he could once again make a phone call. We know for a fact he calls his brother to report he's bleeding, and then also calls Ledessa numerous times in the span of a few minutes. Now, we know he also told his brother to hurry, and this isn't the first time he said it. Not only that, but since the last time he said it, to the 911 operator, he's gone from not needing an ambulance to bleeding, which some say could have been caused by jagged branches, not gunshots. But this assertion, in my mind, badly misses the mark in terms of plausibility, specifically due to the dire urgency in Brandon's voice and actions. Men don't generally experience this from scraping their legs on brush, and then make numerous calls for help in the aftermath, even if they're on drugs. There is no doubt in my mind that those final calls to Ledessa Lofton from Brandon's phone were a desperate last attempt to tell her that he loved her and the kids, and nothing more. We know this had to be so incredibly important to him because he'd left angry, and nobody would ever want things to end that way if they could prevent it. We know that people on their deathbeds always say they regret the things they didn't do. So if you were on your last legs and knew that stopping to make another call was going to cost you your life, which was inevitable anyhow due to the circumstances, but you still had this moment to say one last thing, something that surpassed the importance of even your own existence, wouldn't those words be, "I love you"? And then they finally caught up to him. By this time, he's on the ground, suffering, and at their mercy. One way or another, they finished him off, even if their own anger had dissipated and it was only out of necessity at this point. If they didn't shoot him for fear the cops would be too close, then perhaps they just strangled him to end it. Of course, if you're driving a dark, remote Texas highway in the middle of the night on a Thursday, it's likely you're a local, or perhaps local enough in this barren, unforgiving wilderness to easily find a good place to bury somebody on somebody's private property where it will likely never be found. And that's the last anybody ever hears of Brandon Lawson. In fact, his last words to his brother before their final call gets disconnected are, "I'm 10 minutes away. Hurry up and get here. I'm bleeding." So, this is where the controversy starts, with what happens back at Brandon's truck shortly thereafter. We learn that the real reason this mystery isn't going to be solved is because the police don't want it to be, at least to a certain extent. Others would say it's the family that prevented Brandon from being found. But no matter what you believe, this situation did not transpire in the manner it should have. Now, Brandon's infamous 911 call takes place at 12:54 a.m. on August 9, 2013. And by 1:10 a.m. that night, only 16 minutes later, his brother Kyle, who fielded the urgent call about Brandon bleeding, shows up at the scene with his girlfriend Audrey. The first thing they see is a deputy Neil from the sheriff's office checking out Brandon's vehicle. So it's a fact that not even 15 minutes pass between the time Brandon calls his brother, after making the 911 call at 12:54, and the police arriving at the scene. Now, Brandon is nowhere to be found, and there's no sign of foul play because the incident didn't take place on the roadside, and the motive was simply revenge, perpetrated by strangers. They had no cause to steal his truck, or even to search it for valuables, as that was not their intention to begin with. So, Deputy Neil doesn't mention to Kyle or Audrey that Brandon called 911, presumably because he didn't know. He was responding to a report of a truck parked with its tail end out on the road, as reported by the truck driver that drove past a few minutes earlier. So Kyle goes on to explain that his brother ran out of gas and called him for help, but doesn't mention the part about Brandon bleeding because, according to him, he thinks it's only because his brother is hiding in the bushes due to an old warrant out for his arrest on drug-related charges. Now, to be clear, this was not a situation where the cops were trying to track him down for a serious crime. He just ended up with a warrant for failure to pay some type of fine in the past, What normally happens in these situations is that the cops don't bother to look for you, but if you encounter them and they run your info, you're screwed. So Kyle speculated that when he arrived to find the cop already on the scene, that Brandon was hiding in the bushes to avoid him. Remember, Kyle doesn't know his brother called the cops, so he's trying to protect Brandon from them at this point. The cop then asks Kyle if he's Brandon because he arrives with a gas can, to which he replies he's not. The deputy goes on to mention that he's responding to the 911 call about the vehicle in the road, and Kyle replies that Brandon should be back any minute. All the while, of course, Kyle is hoping the cop will leave so Brandon can show himself. Now, the deputy finds no damage to the truck, and Brandon's wallet and keys are not in it. Of course, I think what's important to remember here, from the cop's perspective, is that the fact the vehicle is out of gas makes it a stranded vehicle, rather than giving the perception of being an abandoned vehicle. There's later speculation that the deputy does little more than drive up and down the road looking for Brandon, but in the context of what he's been led to believe transpired, this not only seems reasonable, but necessary. He's looking for a dude walking to the gas station. And meanwhile, Kyle can't tell the cops his brother said he was bleeding because, if he does, then they're definitely going to continue looking for him until he's found, or at least until they determine he can't be found. What's troubling about this is that the family seems to think the police were neglectful in their actions, but in fact, the family, specifically Kyle, precipitated the events that led to the misunderstanding between the two parties when he neglected to immediately reveal the situation to the cops as he understood it. These were the crucial minutes in the aftermath of the 911 call, and a brother's effort to help his sibling avoid the cops succeeds perfectly, and in the most tragic of ways, as we learn later, of course. Now, how do we summarize Kyle's actions? More specifically, what makes them so hard to swallow? The fact that his actions in this situation utilize the disunity between strong desire, protecting his brother from the cops by withholding information, and poor logic, also protecting his brother from the cops by withholding information. This is essentially the climax of a Shakespearean tragedy, with Brandon's 911 call being the accompanying soliloquy from which we're expected to extract the totality of meaning. Even more tragically, Deputy Neal leaves the scene 8 minutes after arriving in order to search the roadway for Brandon, and does so without running his plates first, which would have alerted him to a warrant and also to the fact everything was not as it seemed here. Simply put, he would have investigated further. But when he leaves, Audrey, who thinks Brandon is really hiding in the bushes, texts him to let him know. Brandon then calls her, but even though his signal is terrible and the call fades in and out, she's able to, again, make out that he says he's bleeding. And by 3 a.m., the phone is finally either turned off or its battery dies. Either way, Brandon Lawson is gone forever. It isn't until the next morning at 7 a.m. that Kyle goes back to Brandon's truck and leaves a can full of gas, in case his brother comes back. It's at this time he decides to come clean with the cops and tell them what Brandon really said on their phone call. Even more interesting, however, is that the cops don't follow up with the information that Brandon called 911 the night before, even though they are almost certainly aware by this point. In fact, police never tell the family, and they only learn the truth when Ledessa sees it itemized on a phone bill from the cell provider. Even then, she only manages to get a copy of the 911 call from police after more than 4 months of requesting it. In addition, police have been avid about preventing the family from asking permission to search from private landowners, raising suspicion in the eyes of many, some of whom still believe the 911 call was clearly edited to remove a reference to an unknown state trooper. Either way, the last official search conducted by police on October 24, 2013, utilized a group of cadaver dogs, but ultimately they came up empty on any definitive clues. And to this day, he's still out there. Somewhere. The last beacon of hope was the final ping from Brandon's cell phone in the middle of the night on that dreadful night of August 9th, which was about 3 miles from his truck and several hours after his last call. Now, There's some speculation that earlier in the evening, Brandon might have decided to forego driving to his father's house and instead headed north on Highway 277 toward Abilene for another reason. Yet a simple online search for directions between the city where Brandon lived, San Angelo, and his father's home, Crowley, reveals this route is simply an alternative to heading east on Highway 67 toward the same destination. I'm not a local, of course, but if I had to guess, I'd say Brandon probably chose this route due to some type of small advantage provided by favoring it over the other road in these circumstances. For instance, if he wanted to avoid the presence of cops because he was intoxicated in some manner, I would say he proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was correct in this assumption, evidenced by the fact that calling them wasn't even enough to get them to show up before he was swallowed by the night and never seen again. And with that action, taking the road less traveled, literally, let's see how it could be defined afterward. When Brandon utilized the disunity between strong desire, avoiding the cops, and poor logic, driving intoxicated on a desolate road, he ended up dying because he could no longer drive his vehicle and couldn't get help from the cops either. Again, his results are predetermined at every step, and fueled by an abnormal logic that is not of the nature of a daily drug habit, which kills one slowly, but every bit a drug binge, or bender, as it's more commonly known. And sometimes, at least on a subconscious level, this is indicative of something the person feels very strongly within, but has not yet realized in the form of rational thought. And that is specifically this notion: I don't want to live anymore. And while this isn't a declaration of suicide, nor is it a statement that you're just going to lay down and die, it is something that would be inherent in your choices, especially if all of those choices rendered you dead at the end. So maybe Brandon Lawson was fed up with life. It is very much possible to love your wife and children with all your heart, but still hate your life, your physical self, or even just the struggle associated with your circumstances. I can say that in my own life, I was recently very unhappy with a car I'd been driving for a few years, to the extent I felt like I'd been cursed by it. But I couldn't afford anything better, so I suffered the piece of junk as long as I could until the engine seized one day long before it should have, and completely to my surprise. At the moment it finally broke down, though, something struck me as such an amazing relief, even though I was left with no car or resale value in the aftermath. But then I took inventory of the circumstances, and in retrospect, it was easy to see that I was not only intentionally neglectful in maintaining the car, but that I'd actually intentionally sabotaged it. And while trying to extend my denial of this truth, it hit me like a ton of bricks that this happened at a time when, only days earlier, I would have not been able to get a new car, but had just received an offer sheet for a new job that allowed me to do so. Of course, there was never a time during this process where I was able to see the truth, until it was over. I was angry, frustrated, and unwilling to live with that vehicle another day. And if you think it's irrelevant or shallow to make this comparison between a car and a human being, just apply that logic to some of the worst moments in your life, and also to Brandon breaking down on the side of the road for good. And I promise you will see the trail of gasoline running consistently straight through to the end. And when you do, when it's evident that there was nothing left to hide for Brandon, that a simple spark would send everything up in smoke for good, that's what happened. And the thing that's so appealing about suicide, even on a subconscious level, is that at the moment the truth is finally revealed, the circumstances allow you to remain free of denial, and subsequently, by way of death, free of pain altogether. And right at this moment, I have no doubt there are a certain number of people listening to this and thinking I'm an incredible jackass for believing this is true. But before making up your mind, I ask you to consider this. Brandon only called 911 for help one time, yet phoned Ledessa, Kyle, and Audrey nearly 10 times. The manner in which he sought help was inversely proportional to the danger, to an extent that his actions are beyond baffling. Once again, he utilized strong desire and poor logic, The only correct move in this circumstance is to continue to try to convey your location and situation to the police. But he didn't. We need to ask ourselves why, and do so in the absence of the he would never complex that blinds us from the overwhelming internal strife of others. Brandon's choices that night and his resulting death were a perfect symbiotic relationship waiting to converge from the disunity of strong desire and poor logic. And once they merged, as he had hoped, he found peace from his suffering. But Brandon was not trying to get to his father's house that night. He was trying to get away. And his truck ran out of gas because it couldn't take him to that place, no matter how far he drove. In the end, however, when he was finally able to see the simple metaphorical implications of his actions, he let go. Forever. But what about Ladessa and their children, whose lives have gone on and will continue to move forward in the face of this hardship, and for whom the BS I've outlined here certainly won't suffice as an answer to why Brandon never came home? For that, I simply have no words, and will make no attempts beyond wishing all of these people the very best of happiness and health for as long as they live. But for the rest of us, those who didn't know Brandon, and have gathered in places like the one we're in now to pontificate about the possibilities until we're blue in the face, what is it that makes this story so irresistible? More specifically, why is it so compelling in the absence of any personal involvement? It's because engaging a disunity between strong desire and poor logic is what caused humanity to start looking to the heavens in the first place for answers, rather than our hearts. And with that, we believe that wherever Brandon Lawson went, it's an answer we'll never know until the moment we finally join him. And this is when we realize why we want to know so badly. The way Brandon Lawson disappeared is no different from the way most of us leave this world. He ran out of gas on the long road he'd been traveling, and then realized something was chasing him, catching up to him, looming over his existence with outreached hands. But there was nowhere to run, except darkness and silence.